Did you get a copy of the outline when you came in? If you did, it's no thanks to Buddy. I couldn't help it. He's just not used to me occasionally being efficient and bringing the outlines in before Sunday morning at 9:15. And so he was cleaning up and cleaned up the outlines. But I got here early enough to... The one time he throws them away is the one time that I happen to actually get him up here early. So I got here early enough this morning that I did notice it and was able to get him reprinted for us today. So if you need one, wave your hand. Sorry. I couldn't resist. Buddy told me, we're shaking his head. He says, I'll deny it. You can't prove it. I said, that sounds like a lawyer to me. All right. Well, we return to our study in John's Gospel this morning. And I tell you, there's an experiment I would love to have an opportunity to do, but I don't think it'd ever be practical. Just imagine for a moment that we could take 100 people and ask them to sit down and read through each of the four Gospels, up to and including Jesus' trial before Annas and Caiaphas and Herod and Pilate, and stop there. And not let them, and tell them we're stopping early. They don't get to read the part about his crucifixion and resurrection yet. But tell them what I want them to do is read through those. Somebody who's never heard the story of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. And ask them to read through those. And then I'm going to ask them to guess which person they met in the reading of those four Gospels. Which person would be the one selected by Christ to be the first person to whom he would appear after his resurrection. Who do you think they'd expect? Who do you might guess? If you were one of those people and didn't know the story, maybe Peter or John? John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, if you understood that's who that was. Maybe just said the disciple whom he loved that John mentions. Peter, maybe because, if for no other reason, to chew him out for denying him the night before he was crucified, right? Maybe his mom, you know, his mother would be somebody. Maybe Annas and Caiaphas for their accusations of blasphemy. Maybe even Pilate for having convicted him unjustly and had him crucified after pronouncing him innocent. But I can almost guarantee that none of those 100 people would pick Mary Magdalene. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but if you take away all of the accounts, I mean, we find her standing at the cross on when he's crucified, seeing him die. We find her as one of those who saw his body claimed by the members of the Sanhedrin who took him to bury him and saw where he was buried. We see her in the accounts of his crucifixion, his resurrection. But I don't know if you've ever recognized just how rarely she shows up in the gospel narratives prior to that. If you take away the accounts of the crucifixion and resurrection, if you take that out and read just the portions I mentioned, right up through his trial and conviction and being sent away to be crucified, if you stop there, John hasn't mentioned her at all in his gospel prior to this. And in fact, neither did Matthew, and neither did Mark. Luke is the only one to have mentioned her so far. And he mentions her one time in Luke chapter 8 when he gives a list of women who were following Jesus. He mentions one named Mary who was called Magdalene, out of whom 7 demons had been cast. That's it. I'd frankly be surprised if any of those people in my experiment even noticed her and remembered her. I mean, Salome is more prominent. Joanna is more prominent. Do you remember them? Prior to the crucifixion and resurrection, they're more prominent. Their names get mentioned more often. And I think that's going to be important. I mean, her encounter, we already saw her last week as being one who got to the tomb first and saw it was empty and open and ran back to get Peter and John, right? We already saw that she was the one to do that. Well, as John recounts here in our text today, verses 11 to 18, he tells of her encounter with Jesus on this morning with very little detail, and it's told quite simply, but it's still quite moving when you try to put yourself there and think about what was going on. It's in this text we learn, really, for the first time, of her profound love for Jesus. But we also see the tremendous condescension of Christ to minister to the broken heart of this woman who was otherwise almost completely obscure. Nobody outside the circle of these women would really, and maybe the disciples would really even know her. And as far as we can tell, there was nothing about her that made companionship with her socially advantageous, okay? She was not the kind of person people longed to be close to. She had been demon-possessed. And we don't know anything else about her. But there's nothing about her that commends her to our attention prior to this. And then related to that is something I've mentioned before, that's we need to acknowledge the wisdom of God in authenticating the story of Christ's resurrection the way he does. I mean, it's easy, as I've said, it's really easy to miss in our 21st century Western culture, where, frankly, women are quite prominent in every social context in our culture today. Not true in first century Jewish culture or Greco-Roman culture or really pretty much any culture even today other than modern Western culture. Certainly not true in Muslim-dominated countries, right? But the validation of the story of Jesus' death and his resurrection, the crucified and resurrected Messiah, depends almost entirely on the testimony of women. Only the women could attest to the fact that he actually died. None of the disciples, except maybe John came back, none of the disciples, except maybe John, had stuck around for his death and to see his death. Only the women actually saw two members of the Sanhedrin take him away to bury him. They were the only ones who actually witnessed where he was buried. They were the first ones to see that the tomb was empty, and now Mary becomes the first one to encounter the risen Christ. And there's absolutely no way any first century Jew would have made up a story like that. No way. God's elevation of women to such a prominent place is a powerful testimony to the truth of the account. I would also suggest this makes patently ridiculous the popular accusations today that Christianity oppresses women. The religion that oppresses women is Islam. It's not Christianity. It has never been Christianity, and Islam still oppresses women more even than Jewish culture and Greco-Roman culture did. Which makes it absolutely astounding that so many women in liberal political bents are so defensive of Islam in our land, and even suggesting maybe we ought to allow Sharia law. Hey, if that's what they think, they don't understand Sharia law, and they don't understand what life under that might be for them. Anyway, I don't mean to make this a political soapbox. But with this by way of introduction, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read this in small segments as we go to see the development of the story. Let's begin now with a word of prayer. Father, we ask that you would add your blessing to our study of your word today as we will read the text and examine it and see what you have here for us. Help us to understand what happens. Help us to appreciate the emotional significance of this event as well as the theological, and may we be encouraged and instructed and blessed for having studied your word today. And Lord, if there's one without Christ, may they recognize their need of the Savior and turn to him even this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, we see in the first three verses of this text, verses 11 to 13, that as this paragraph begins, that Mary encounters angels at the tomb. It says, but Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping, and so as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been lying. And they said to her, woman, why are you weeping? She said to them, because they have taken away my Lord,
And I do not know where they've laid him.
This is a very touching scene. Mary was stated here that she's standing outside the tomb. It starts with the word, but, and so there's got to be a contrast, right? That's an adversative. This is in contrast to something else. The contrast is that the disciples, Peter and John, who had come to the tomb, they'd looked in, seen that it was empty, and they'd gone home. Mary's still there. Mary is in contrast to their having left, she's still there, so she's alone. That's the point. She was alone at this point. Now, John doesn't tell us exactly about all the movements. We don't know for sure if she had returned with Peter and John as they ran back. She had been there. She had walked there before dawn. She had seen it was empty. She had run back to get them. If it's Bethany, it's 2 miles each way. So she's run back to Bethany, maybe, to find Peter and John. Peter and John have run to the tomb. It seems likely that she would have proceeded at a little slower pace on the return. Let them go ahead, and I'll just catch them when I get there. So I suspect that in John's telling of Peter and John running, they didn't even stay together. So I suspect she didn't travel with them on the way back, that they got there ahead of her, checked everything out, and then left. Whether she encountered them on the way as they were leaving, we don't know. But what we do know is that she is at this point unaware of the empty grave clothes still being in the tomb. She hadn't seen them the first time, and she hasn't communicated with Peter and John, who actually saw the empty grave clothes. And so it seems that she hasn't actually talked to them at this point. But she was by herself, and we find that she is there, and she is weeping. She was weeping, and the word used for these tears is not the word translated wept when Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus, when he shed quiet tears. This is the word for what the mourners were doing at the tomb of Lazarus. Some of them were professionals, paid to weep and wail and go caterwauling about to demonstrate the depth of their grief, mostly the paid ones. It was kind of fake, but it was kind of a weird custom that the Jews had there to hire professionals to mourn because they were so good at sounding loud and sad. But this was genuine. Nobody's paying her to do this. Nobody's even seeing her do this. This is how she feels. It's an outpouring of her soul in grief and weeping. She is absolutely distraught as she's standing there by the tomb, and she stoops down to peek into the tomb. It's the same verb used for what John did when he arrived. He peeked in. It's a single word that means to stoop down and look in. He didn't go in. You know, John did that when he first got there, and then Peter came dashing right past him and went right in. Well, Mary does exactly the same thing John had done. He uses exactly the same verb, and it's the same verb form. And when she peeks in, she sees something astounding. She saw two angels seated where Jesus' body had been. Now, again, this tomb was hewn out of the limestone of the region, and only the wealthiest of Jews could have afforded a tomb that we're seeing described here. Evidently, the opening where the stone was removed, Mark is the one who tells us it was thrown out of the way, not rolled aside, but the opening into that, you'd have to stoop to get in, but it opened into a larger alcove where at least two people could go, because we know Peter and John were both inside at the same time. And with apparently room enough to turn around. Maybe not enough room enough to walk around, but it had kind of an alcove there. But there would also be shelves on which bodies could be laid, more than one. Frequently they would radiate out like spokes of a wheel. But this seems to be a bench where there would be an angel seated at the head and at the foot. Again, this implies something quite roomy for a tomb, if you will. More like a mausoleum today that we might think of, but it was hewn out of the rock. And she looks in there and sees these two angels inside. Now, the only description that John provides is they were dressed in white.
They were dressed in white. Now Luke, when Luke describes this in Luke 24, 1 to 7, he talks about angels appearing to the other women who apparently saw them and then left, and now they're still there when Mary gets there. He describes them as men dressed in dazzling clothing in Luke 24, 1 to 7. He describes those who appeared at Jesus' ascension in the same, basically the same way. Excuse me, in Acts chapter 1, which Luke also wrote, Acts chapter 1, verses 9 to 11, he describes two men in white clothing there. Now, I have heard preachers who have come to those passages in Luke and said, Luke says they were men, so they weren't angels, they were men. But I don't know what they do with John saying that Mary saw angels and describing them the same way. They end up having to say that the men who were dressed in white that the women saw together and that were at the ascension left, and that Mary saw two other beings that were angels dressed the same way. I think that's kind of silly to try to play those kind of games. Just because they're so literalist in their understanding of the word men that they assumed they were humans. You see, we have an earlier example. Way back in the earliest time that angels appeared anywhere in Genesis chapter 18, Abraham is beginning to doubt that Sarah is going to have a child, and three men show up at Abraham's camp. Genesis 18 talks about three men who show up at his camp. And so Abraham says, sit down, we'll fix you dinner. And it takes a while to kill the animal and get it dressed out and get the meat roasted and so on. So dinner is going to be a while preparing. You don't fix all that real quick. And so they sit there and they chat. And as the conversation goes on, we find one of them is talking about Sarah being the one who's going to be the child. And he ends up being identified as the Lord. And then at the end of the chapter, the other two are sent, the one identified as the Lord sends the other two to go on down to Sodom to deal with Lot. And as chapter 19 opens, they're described as angels. So I don't have any problem with saying that the people John described as angels and Luke described as men are the same beings. In fact, when human beings interact with angels, in almost every case, except in some of the visions, like in Ezekiel's visions are kind of weird, Isaiah visions of the angels around the throne. Daniel has some visions about angels and such. But when others are encountering angels, they generally don't distinguish themselves by the way they look. They're distinguished by the way they act. And so I don't have any problem with these looking like regular guys. And Mary does not seem to be particularly awestruck in their presence. She doesn't respond to them with overwhelming wonder or awe as if she was seeing something remarkable. When she sees them, she responds to them the way she would anybody who asked her what they asked, although I think she does it maybe with a little more grace than I might have, because the question strikes me as at least insensitive. Does it strike you that way? An old friend of mine, going back 35 years or more, Sherry, you remember Coit Morrison, good guy. He posted something on Facebook about a month or so ago, maybe probably 2 months ago now, something that had happened to him recently. He had been traveling around doing some research in his family history, and he was out near Seattle, Washington, because his roots go back that way. He was born out that way. And he was in a cemetery checking headstones and getting some information about his family history while he was out there. And while he was there in the cemetery, he happened to see someone he described as an older woman standing by herself next to a fresh grave. I mean, it had been freshly filled in. The dirt was bare and it hadn't leveled off and grass hadn't grown over it. And he saw her there while he was doing his business. He happened to notice her at some distance. And he went ahead and finished his business, got in his car, and drove away. Left the cemetery and was back on the road. And he said, it just couldn't get her out of my mind. And I felt like maybe the Lord was telling me I should go talk to her. And so he said, I turned around and I drove back. And he wasn't bragging. He said, this is just something the Lord did for me that day. As something special the Lord did for him that day. And so he said, I went back, and she was still there. I figured maybe she's already gone. But no, she was still standing there. So he said, I drove up, parked the car. I got out and walked up to her, and I just stood there next to her for a few minutes. And then I asked her, would you tell me about him? And she started to cry even more. And she talked for nearly an hour. And then gave him a hug, and she said, thanked him for his compassion, and said, you know, I think God sent you to me today. He said, I think so too, because I needed this. Now, my point is not the example of profound compassion that Coit Morrison demonstrated that day. My point is that he did not walk up to her and said, lady, why are you crying? That would have seemed remarkably insensitive, almost rude. But here you have Mary Magdalene sobbing and weeping and carrying on, and she looks in and sees the angels, and they say, woman, why are you weeping? I'd have a hard time being polite if somebody asked me that question in that context, wouldn't you? I think it'd be, why do you think I'm crying? Okay. But she doesn't respond that way. It's a great testament to her character that she shows some restraint in that she doesn't respond that way. And I don't think any of us would have asked her that question that way in that kind of a context. They said, woman, why are you weeping? Now, the word woman is not condescending. It's not insulting. It's a respectful form of address. Jesus has used it in talking to his mother on a couple of occasions, and I've made that point. But what they're replying is, by the way they ask the question, they're implying that there's really no reason, legitimate reason for her sadness. There's no legitimate reason for her grief and tears. Well, she doesn't have, now we happen to know something she doesn't know yet. But she doesn't know this. The situation for Mary has changed in ways that haven't been disclosed to her yet. She certainly hasn't understood. But as she answers quite respectfully and quite restrainedly, I guess, it does lack the awe that you might have expected in the presence of angels. It reveals she's completely ignorant of what's happened, actually, and the profound nature of her grief. And so she explains, they've taken away the body of my Lord, and I do not know where they've laid him. I don't know how long it took her to get that out as she's choking through her sobs. She doesn't define they. She hadn't defined they before because she's not sure who to accuse, but she seems to be assuming that it's the Jewish leaders. When she reported the empty tomb, she'd said almost exactly the same thing. This time she doesn't use the plural. When she reported to the disciples, she said, we don't know where they've laid him, because she'd apparently gone with the other women. This time she says, I don't know where they've laid him. She uses the singular. She had come because she wanted to show respect to Jesus' body. Evidently, somebody's stolen it, placed it where she can't find it, and she's weeping because she assumed Jesus was still dead. You understand why she makes that assumption? We would all assume that. She assumed he was still dead and that she couldn't find his body. She did not have any expectation of meeting a risen Christ. That's something we need to get through our heads. That's what part of what John is saying. She didn't go there looking for a miracle. She went there looking for a corpse. And she's saddened because she can't find it to show the respect she wanted to show. But it's at that moment when she makes that proclamation that she meets Jesus in the garden. That's Roman numeral 2. She met Jesus in the garden. Verses 14 to 17. When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus said to her, Mary. And she turned and said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. Jesus said to her, stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, and my God and your God. What I want to see here, you know, some speculate that she turned around because the angels motioned to somebody standing behind her. There's nothing in the text that indicates that. I honestly suspect that she turned around due less to someone being having sent someone behind her than to just turning away from what was becoming an uncomfortable conversation with strangers. They asked her an odd question, and she's expressed her grief and really don't want to talk about it anymore because they don't seem... I think it's remarkable that she doesn't say, who are you and what are you doing where he was? But she doesn't get in their face, but she just rather demurely is turning away. And she turned and saw Jesus, but she did not recognize him. John makes that very clear. She turned and saw Jesus, but she did not recognize him. And then Jesus asked her exactly the same question asked by the angels. And that's kind of unusual for John to repeat something verbatim. He tends to modify the wording just a little bit, just for variety's sake. Evidently, the exactness of the wording was important. And so he reports them, he quotes these two questions as identical. What, woman, why are you weeping? Now, I don't know whether she's just so distraught that she no longer has the energy to be indignant or what, that here she's being asked the same seemingly ridiculous question a second time, and she remains polite, she remains deferential to these people who seem to be strangers, even though they are at best seem quite insensitive. But then Jesus adds another question and asks, whom do you seek? Now, that's a new question. The angels hadn't asked that. Whom do you seek? Now, I think there's maybe a hint here of the surprise that she's about to recognize. There's a sense in which what she came looking for was actually not someone but something, the corpse of the one who's no longer here. But the implication is there maybe you should be looking for a person. She's looking for someone. She still doesn't get it. She still doesn't recognize Jesus. And and John specifically tells us she assumes he's the gardener. He doesn't explain why Mary didn't recognize and didn't know who he was, but you know that doesn't stop preachers and commentators from speculating. Why she didn't. In my preparation and in various contexts where I've heard people preaching on this text, I've heard several different suggestions. Some suggest, well, probably her eyes were so blurred by tears she couldn't really make out his features. I don't know anybody who's ever cried so hard that they couldn't recognize a beloved teacher or friend when he's standing in front of them. That to me is not very likely explanation. There are others who have suggested, well, meeting was just so unexpected. You know, it didn't register because she assumed he was dead. Or maybe because the last time she had seen him, she was so badly disfigured, so badly beaten and bruised that she wouldn't have expected him to look so healthy as did the risen Christ. I don't think that makes much sense either, to tell you the truth. John MacArthur voices a similar opinion and actually goes a little farther. He says this, he says, quote, Jesus' resurrection body was more glorious than before and certainly did not match her vivid memories of him, especially the battered, bruised, bloody corpse she had seen on the cross, end quote. And honestly, there are a couple of reasons I don't like MacArthur's explanation. One of them goes back to something I said last week. He's assuming a transformation of Jesus' body that scriptures never actually state. As I said last week, when you and I rise from the dead, we'll be transformed. And when this corruptible puts on incorruptible, I believe we'll still be recognizable, though, as ourselves. And furthermore, you can make a case from Scripture, I believe, a case, whether or not it's what you think is really true, a case can be made that Jesus' body was never subject to corruption, because he had not inherited the curse of sin. And so I think he's assuming something not necessarily in evidence. After his resurrection, he'll walk into a room that was locked on a couple of occasions. But before his resurrection, he walked on water. Before his resurrection, he passed through hostile crowds, wanted to throw him off a cliff. I didn't mention last week that he even climbed in a ship after walking on the water and transported it immediately to the opposite shore. So it was suddenly there. They didn't have to row the rest of the way. He had revealed his glory, a glimpse of his glory, to John and Peter and James on the Mount of Transfiguration. I'm a little uncomfortable with that part of MacArthur's explanation, but another part of it, I think he really misses is the fact that Mary, he assumes Mary saw him in his glory and didn't recognize him, but I don't think you'd immediately think gardener, if that's the case, right? For instance, there have been several times that I've been working around the yard here, watering flowers or weeding flower beds or out cutting the grass or running the weed eater or something. And there have been more than one occasion where people have pulled in to ask questions about the church. And I've had people come in and flag me down and come up and say, is the pastor around? And I'll put down the weed eater and say, well, I'm the pastor. And they'll look kind of funny and say, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were the groundskeeper or something. I say, well, I am today. But, you know, they didn't assume I was a groundskeeper because I looked more glorious than usual, right? Thanks, Doug. Right. Doug and Trent did the lawn this week, and we're grateful for that. But when you're done doing the lawn and you've been running the weed eater, people don't look at you and think, glory. Okay? And if Jesus is there and Mary doesn't recognize him because of the glorious nature of his resurrection body, I don't think she immediately goes to gardener as who she assumes he is. And so I don't like that explanation. I don't think it's adequate. So what do I think is going on? I'll get to that in just a moment. But what Mary assumes, because she thinks he's the gardener, if he's the gardener, maybe he was here when they took the body and he knows what happened. Or maybe he helped move the body. When whoever opened the tomb did so, maybe they made him help. And he might know what's going on because he knows the garden where this tomb is, if he's the gardener. And so she said, if you are the one who carried him away, tell me where you laid him. I'll take him away. She offers to transport Jesus' body. She didn't say bring him back. Apparently, she assumed that if the tomb was open and somebody took him, if I find the body, that's not where I want to put him, because if they took him once, they'll take him again. Look, I'll take care of getting him somewhere else. If there's a problem with his being here, just tell me where he is. I got to tell you, I find myself wondering how she planned to do that. Okay, I suspect it's her grief speaking more than really thinking this through. Says, look, I'll take care of it. I'm not sure how she expected to get him from wherever he is to wherever she wanted to take him, but maybe he would let her at least go get help. But she's offering to take care of this. Fortunately, she's not going to have to do that. But that's what she offers. And then Jesus spoke her name. Then Jesus spoke her name. And again, various commentators have various variations on the same theme. Something in the way he said her name. And suddenly she knew who he was. Merrill Tenney, for instance, said this, quote, no gardener would ever know her name, and no one else would pronounce it the way Jesus did, end quote. Leon Morris says something similar. He said, quote, something in the way the name was spoken caught her attention, end quote. But I got to tell you, I don't think that's what's going on either. I don't think she finally recognized his voice. I don't think that's what John means. He's already asked her a couple of questions, and now he calls her name, and she finally recognizes the voice. If nothing else, I suspect if that's what it was, she bursts into tears again because it reminds her of the one she came to find. She doesn't immediately think the resurrected Lord. That's not where your mind would go. Here's what I think happened. You might recall back in John chapter 10, Jesus is giving his discourse on himself as the good shepherd. And in John chapter 10, I cited verses 2 to 4 as a cross-reference here. He says this, "But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice." It's John's gospel that quotes that, and Jesus has made a lot of that point, and John has emphasized that throughout. And so the point is not that Mary didn't know him till he called her name because she just didn't recognize who he was. But the point is that when he called this particular one of his sheep by name, she immediately knew him to be the shepherd. And all objections, all the evidence that might have stood up in her face and said, "He can't be, he's dead," she threw all that out and assumed he's the resurrected Christ. She suddenly believed in a resurrection because she heard his name, heard him call her name. Here's the point John wants us to get from this and the way he's told this story. The first post-resurrection encounter is intended to illustrate the truth that no one can ever recognize the resurrected Christ until he calls them to himself by name. No one ever recognizes the risen Christ. Paul didn't. In Romans chapter, in Acts chapter 9, when he was Saul of Tarsus. In fact, what we will see in all of the accounts of the resurrected Christ, nobody knows him at first. Nobody understands immediately. But when he calls her name, when he manifests himself to them, that's a phrase John will use frequently, the scales fall off. They see the Lord. And the truth is, you'd have never recognized him either if he hadn't called to you. Not necessarily an audible voice calling your name, but it's Christ's call to you that makes the scales fall off so that you see him and turn to him and are saved. And as soon as he called her name, she cried out, "Rabboni," and clung to him. I don't know how much I should make of the name, the word Rabboni. Again, commentators sometimes make a fairly big thing about this. The word is an intensified form of the more diminutive rabbi. Rabbi is the typical title for a teacher. Rabboni is intensified. It's great teacher or exalted teacher. In the older Jewish literature, it's almost never used as a form of address, and the only time in that literature it's ever found used in address, as I understand it, is when addressing God in prayer. And so it may be that those commentators who make this point are correct when they say that her calling him Rabboni is essentially equivalent to what Thomas will later say when he cries out, "My Lord and my God." That may be. However, I'd be more comfortable making that point if that's what John said this meant. What John does here is he takes the name Rabboni and just gives it the Greek translation with the equivalent word teacher. He doesn't make a big deal about the intensifiers. So I hesitate to make too much of it. But that is a possible point to be made. Now, what happens what Jesus says to her after she does that has been translated in the King James as "touch me not," but I think that translation is a little misleading because the verb form used there about touching does not mean don't do what you're thinking about doing or what you're about to do. It means stop doing what you're doing now. So it's not like she was about to stretch out her finger to touch him, see if he's real, and says, no, don't touch me. As if there was something that was a danger to him or to her if she did. It's something she's already doing. And he says, you need to stop. Stop clinging to me. That's what I think this this translation here is preferable. Now, what he says next has, I think, often been badly misunderstood. I don't think he was concerned that contact with her might defile him. Don't touch me because I can't be defiled by your filthiness until I go to the Father. I don't think that's what he's saying, although some have suggested that. It's just going to be a few days when he will invite, 8 days, that he will invite Thomas to touch him, even though he still hasn't returned to the Father. And so for the outline, I just said it this way. I said he told her, he means that she can't touch him yet. She shouldn't touch him yet. Excuse me, that's not what he means. He does not mean she can't touch him. Getting ahead of myself. He doesn't mean she can't touch him yet, as if something had to happen before it was safe, or before something had to happen to her before she was qualified. He doesn't mean that. If that's the case, it's already too late, right? She's apparently fallen on the ground and grabbed him by the ankles, is how I think we should picture this. And he's saying, look, stop clinging to me. It would have been really out of character for a first century Jewish woman to have wrapped her arms around him and given him a big hug. But probably more like grabbing around his ankles. I think what he means is this, that she need not cling to him because he hasn't returned yet. He's not leaving yet. Look, you don't need to be clinging to me. I'm not going back to the Father yet. I have not yet returned to the Father. She doesn't know he's only going to be there for about 40 days and only appearing kind of in random places and at random times. But I don't think he means, look, if you this is dangerous for one of us. But then he gave her something to do. He had something for her to do. He says, he sent her to tell my brethren of his coming ascension. Go tell them I'm going back. Now, who does he mean by my brethren? Well, it seems fairly obvious to us because we're familiar with the epistles. But it's not nearly so obvious here at this point in the New Testament narrative. We know that his physical brothers, the sons of Mary and Joseph, had not believed in him before his crucifixion. He's mentioned them as his brethren when they were urging him to go up for the Feast of Tabernacles and he was not wanting to go right yet. We also know that on the night before his crucifixion, we will find his brothers converted shortly after his resurrection, because by the time Acts opens, they're converted and they're meeting with the other believers. But they weren't yet. We know that on the night before his crucifixion, as he's talking to his disciples, he said, I'm not going to call you slaves anymore, I'm going to call you friends. Right? Remember that? In John chapter 15? But nowhere else in the Gospels has Jesus called his disciples brethren. Unless we consider that it's kind of implied in Mark chapter 3, verses 33 and 34. One time Jesus was teaching a group of disciples, and somebody came in and interrupted him while he was teaching and said, your mother and your brothers are here, and they want to see you. And he said, who are my mother and my brothers? And then looking about at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. That's the closest, that's the only reference where we might say that he's referred to the believers, the disciples, as brethren. But if Jesus meant for Mary to deliver this message to his actual brothers, his physical half-brothers, sons of Mary and Joseph, it's a little remarkable and actually startling that she disregards the instruction, doesn't go there, and goes back to the disciples. I think, given the context, that if that's what he meant, that's what she would have done. And so I think we're safe in assuming he's talking about the disciples, since that's the people to whom she takes the message. However, that being the case, for Jesus to call them my brethren now represents another elevation in their relationship. just a few days ago, 3 days ago, he told them, I'm not going to call you slaves anymore, I'll call you friends. Now I call you brethren. That's new. It's another elevation in the relationship since his resurrection. But then the message he tells her to deliver is phrased a little awkwardly. Right? Did you notice that? Where are we? Verse 17. I ascend to my Father and your Father and my God and your God. Why didn't he just say, I ascend to our Father and our God? Wouldn't that have been easier? This is a little awkward in the way it's phrased. I think it's intentional. Typically is, right? The wording is typically intentional. It sounds a little redundant and at least a little awkward, but I think the phrasing is significant. There's a spiritual sense in which the disciples are his brothers. But we need to understand that Jesus' relationship to the Father remains distinct from theirs. He taught the disciples to pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. But when he prayed, My Father. He spoke of God as my Father. And I would suggest, I submit, that this is something that religious groups like the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses get tragically wrong. They see Jesus as a Son of God, and when we come to Christ, we become sons of God in the same way Jesus is the Son of God. He's just a little ahead of us on the spiritual curve. You know, Jesus did not become a Son of God earlier than us and just kind of get a running start, a head start on us, but that we will eventually catch up. That's what Mormonism teaches. The doctrine of Mormonism is essentially the same thing the serpent said to Adam and Eve in the garden. You will become like gods. That's what Mormonism teaches. That those who follow their ways, and if you're diligent, that you too will ascend to become like a god, and you will be able to be you'll be able to create your own worlds eventually and be lord over those worlds. That's a theology that is reflected in the fiction fantasy literature written by Brandon Sanderson, who teaches creative writing at Brigham Young University. I enjoy his writing, but that's the theology that drives his thinking, that people will become gods through their great deeds. And that the gods are just used to be people, but they did great things, and now they're gods. And that Jesus was a Son of God, and we will be sons of God too. Jesus is the one and only Son of God with a capital S. You and I become children of God by adoption. We have many of the same rights and privileges, but we are not and never will be of the same essence. And so Jesus said, I'm going back to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. He did not say our Father and our God as if our relationship was identical. And so the wording is important that he continues, even when he calls the disciples my brothers, he continues to distinguish between his relationship with the Father and everybody else's. Because his is unique. Because he alone is truly divine. The rest of us kind of enjoy the reciprocal benefits of association with him. But we will never be gods. Mormonism is a blasphemous lie. So is the Jehovah's Witness view that does not see Christ, as sees him as a created being that is... They don't necessarily say we'll all be like gods. They don't have quite that exalted a view of what the Mormons claim. But they devalue Christ and make him more human and less divine. Now, I included verse 18 in this. We haven't read it yet. All I'm going to say about that as I read it. Mary Magdalene came, announcing to the disciples, I have seen the Lord. and that he had said these things to her. The point is that she reported to the disciples what had happened in verse 18. She said, I have seen the Lord. That's an amazing announcement. None of them have seen the Lord yet. This is the first report of Jesus in his resurrection body. I've seen the Lord. Everybody's looking for his corpse. I talked to him, and here's what happened. She reported what he said. Basically, she did what he told her to do, assuming that he didn't tell her to go tell his physical brothers, but he's talking about the disciples. So, in summation, Mary Magdalene had gone there and encountered Jesus Christ, and none of these encounters were accidental. It's not that she just happened to be the one who happened to be there that day. Jesus' appearances, as we will see, were always intentional and always selective. He met with her on purpose to reveal to her himself as the resurrected Lord. And she was the one who was the first one sent with the message that Christ is risen. This woman out of whom seven demons had been cast, the only thing we knew about her before all these events around Jesus' death and resurrection. She faithfully did what Jesus commanded. You know, there's a sense in which you and I are tasked with the same message. We're among the brethren that have heard the word, but we're to take the message out that Christ who died is alive again. He's overcome death, he has triumphed, and he's done so on behalf of his people. We're supposed to take that message to the world without being selective as to who gets to hear it. Now, most of them will never recognize him, but there are some whose name he will call. And they will come to him and they will cling to him. And he's given us the privilege of delivering that message. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word.